I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
All right, everyone, welcome to the November 16th edition of the In The Now show. This is your host, Slip Mode, coming at you again with another episode, and my sidekick,
VR,
in the house, definitely. Well, me and VR have been in a very deep thought mode last few hours, so we're going to be bringing our usual information on the current up-to-date news of things going on and our opinions. We'll also be talking about our review of Matrix, the third one, Revolutions. And, you know, we're going to do that towards the end, actually, to make it fair. So if you want to tune out after that point, you can. And coming at you with another show. Stay tuned. Right. Well, there's been a lot of interesting things going on these past 2 weeks. It's been a lot of interesting things, period, been happening, but I think we've got some pretty provocative out there stories.
But not quite perverted.
Not quite perverted. This is something, I don't think it's been new. I think it's been going on in the past, but now it's becoming sort of an industry. And it's basically cyber, you know, I don't know what term could be appropriate to use, but cyber criminals per se.
Organized hacker threats?
Organized, well, we want to call them criminals instead of hackers.
Oh, okay.
Organized criminal threats towards businesses, either doing denial of services to them and asking for money for it to stop, or other miscellaneous, mischievous activities. And evidence of a new type of international extortion racket emerged basically earlier this month with revelations that blackmailers have been exploiting computer hacking techniques to threaten the ability of companies to conduct business online. Gangs based in Eastern Europe have been found to have been launching waves of attacks on corporate networks, costing the companies millions of dollars in lost business and exposing them to blackmail.
I think that's called extortion.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is extortion, too.
Yeah, because it's like, you know what, you're going to pay protection to me because, you know what, I'm going to, yeah, just essentially deny everyone the service of your services, and you're going to pay me to stop.
Yeah.
And then you're going to continue to pay me so I don't do it again.
Yeah, and it's, you know, with the number of exploits and things that are coming out, especially for Microsoft systems, it's getting a lot, you know, the things are getting in other people's hands, and they're using them. The most recent cases of affected companies have surfaced in Britain, where the National High-Tech Crime Unit, NHTCU, is investigating how one betting side was brought down and then received a threat that it would be attacked again unless tens of thousands of pounds were paid, which is their currency. It is cooperating with international law enforcement agencies, with the perpetrators thought to be based in Eastern Europe. Ian Morris, founder of the Equip Technology, a systems security integrator, said, "We've dealt with six cases now, and it's got to be multiples of that, and not just in the UK. It's obviously a world problem. They seem to be targeting high volume, low value transactional sites."
Yeah, so it's not like a really big crime, but they're going to get their way because of the sheer amount of volume. It makes it easy.
Yeah, you know, there's something to notice here that's going on, is that we've now really become to acknowledge our dependence on these types of systems and networks. And obviously security has now been a big focus. Well, now, focusing on it now may be a little too late, especially in Microsoft's business of getting on the ball or trying to get on the ball. This stage in the game is a little too late, and now we're seeing that these technologies, people, you know, hackers and intellectuals and people that like to figure things out, have been known for years to see the precursors of abused technology. You know, it used to be the corporates.
Well, it's just like with any tool, is you can use, because it does something, you can either use it for productivity or destruction.
Yeah.
And so it's just like a gun. It's a tool. It's however you use it is going to be good or bad outcome.
Yeah. I mean, the corporations, you know, they originally used their technology in abusive ways for market share and things like that. But now they're seeing a new lesson to learn here, is that it's actually being used against them and against their customers. So,
yeah, because I like to go back to that whole, like, how do you, you know, try to patch Swiss cheese? Or do you want to get a different kind of cheese if you don't want it holy?
Hey, you know what? That's one of the best. I'm going to start using that. I never thought of that. That's pretty good, VR.
Well, thank you. Well, that's why I'm the virtual reality here.
Yeah. I think Bweef and Barrett will definitely appreciate that and tell me one of your quotes.
Right on. Yeah, that, I was thinking of you guys.
Awesome. Let's see. Yeah, because VR has a small fan club.
Woohoo!
Yeah, it's a good thing. And, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that was actually real. We have a whole studio audience.
Yeah, we've actually gone live.
Yeah. I'd still like to do that, but I don't know if it'll work, but we'll see. Okay, well, we've talked a lot about quantum processing, computing, encryption, devices, and we've talked about it because it's a new thing. You know, it's going to be very important as far as how security goes. And basically, there's this company called Magic Technologies that announced the first quantum encryption device, basically, and allows you to carry encrypted data that's encrypted quantumly across lines. Magic's Navajo system, a box made to fit in a standard telecom rack, was unveiled in February and began beta trials in March. Magic Q, or Magic, but it's like Magi Q, so I think it's Magic. Says, Navajo performs the usual triple DES and AES encryption standards. What's special is the transmission of the key, a string of random bits used to decipher messages. Computers normally use a random number for a key, producing encryption schemes that could be broken if enough computing power was made available. There's a big vulnerability people see because optical fiber is easy to tap. And there's this one company that they're saying that gets tapped several times a week. So somebody's breaking in and looking at their data that's going across that line. Using quantum and crypto scheme can defend against such taps. In addition to the obvious government and military customers, quantum encryption is finding interest in the financial sector for protecting backups of real-time traffic. Another target would be an industry needing to protect intellectual property, not just high-tech firms, but businesses such as automotive firms, tire manufacturers, and other people. And what we had described before when we had talked about quantum is that we learned that quantum exists in, from what I've read, 32 different states, which is at the atom level. Now, what does that really mean? Well, that means that it's existing in so many different planes. Now, if it's a... If you want to protect against somebody tapping a line of where quantum encryption is going along that line, if you actually tap that line, you actually affect one of the states that the quantum encryption exists in. It's a very deep subject, but...
Well, it's just the whole, like, you know, the old philosophical thing is, if you're if you're the observer, and but by observing the observed... You're actually changing the observed.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, as it's being transmitted, if it's tapped, you're changing it as you're viewing it. Not only can you not decipher it, or you might be able to if you had enough...
But it's now it's detectable.
Yeah, but it's instantly detectable because the person you're sending it to gets crap.
Yeah. It's a, quantum encryption and quantum mathematics is actually... in some ways, in some things, non-proven. Some of it is, like, way out there. But for some reason, it works. And sometimes they don't completely understand why it works, but it does. I'm sure there's somebody out there that understands a lot more of it than I do. But it's a coming technology in the world of high-tech and security, and it's definitely interesting to stay abreast and see what happens with it.
Yeah, it's starting to seem like there's a real inevitable and imminent demand for it in a lot of different fields right now.
Yeah, definitely. Well, going along the lines of file swapping, music swapping, there was actually a survey done by NPD. I actually don't know who that is. Sounds like... almost like NYPD, New York Police Department. It is a New York-based firm. Okay, well, they said in August, 1.4 million households deleted all music files. So is the threat from the RIAA actually working?
Well, I would say so.
It might be. You know, it might be working to some degree. But as we've seen...
But now, has, like, CD sales actually increased? That's what I would think. I would just be like, whatever. I'm not going to buy any from them anyway.
Yeah.
Protest them as the American Democratic consumer. My vote right there is I no longer consume your product.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a whole collaboration, or if it isn't, it's playing out this way, where there's these online companies, wanting to take advantage of that new type of business to get files to you, music to you cheap, and pick what you want and download it in MP3, which is very portable. And also the RIAA trying to scare you, because obviously they can't control it. You just can't control it. But try to scare you into using these services or, not file swapping freely. You know, basically scaring you to put your money, where they'll be able to get their hands at it.
Yeah, it's like, well, you can get this free song right now, but there's the possibility that we will sue you for $100,000 later.
Yeah, even though, it's one song or whatever, it's really ridiculous. But what do you do, try to do what you can. But
rise up. We all form a huge music consumer union and strike and picket.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of these things we've talked about, subjects. There are things that are of a changing age. Actually, every age is changing. But these are the changes that are occurring in this age. And, this show is about describing those changes and allowing people to hear what they are if they don't have the, chance to in their daily, task to look the news up or anything. We have our hour show for you to peruse through and find out what's going on. Be informative.
I think I'm really enjoying this whole, American users, music listeners group where we all, band together and unite and really show that the music industry that, you should really allow file sharing because then you'll at least get some money from us.
Yeah. And also, it's the choice. A lot of those CDs suck. And it's nice to just get the song you want. And it's also...
Then it'll muscle them into actually, allowing artists to produce good music and not forcing them into putting out a couple of singles and filling up the rest of the CD that they're charging you $20 for is a bunch of crap.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's changing world. It's interesting to watch how it plays out. Another thing that's changing is something I would have never seen when I was a kid was the PlayStation Portable. That's right. Sony's going to get into the portable market, it seems, and it's a very slick... Sony always makes kind of slick, futuristic devices, if you see their laptops and such. And it looks really nice. What's interesting that I notice is it actually runs off the MIPS 32-bit R4000 processor, which is what you would see in a typical silicone graphics machine. Let's see. Here it is. Sony has said that the PSP, which is portable PlayStation, or PlayStation Portable, will be powered by a 90-nanometer processor built from a MIPS 32-bit R4000 core. The chip will feature a SIMD vector processing engine along the lines of Intel's SSE2 and PowerPC's AltaVec. It will feature 8 megabytes of embedded memory, clocking to 333 megahertz and operating at 1.2 volts. Memory bandwidth is quoted at 2.6 gigabits per second. So that's...
it also runs off AA's.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's... basically, it's the graphics processor and the normal, typical processor, I think, is built together in one processor. Let's see. Oh, no. A second MIPS R4000 core will be used for the basis of the PSP's media engine and 2 megabytes of embedded DRAM. Okay, there's something else I was reading where they're talking about just mixing the two. And since it's a lot faster, I'll get to that in a second. Let me finish this. It will support... PSP will support Dolby 7.1 multi-channel audio with 3D sound. It will support MP3, AAC, Sony's own A-Track 3 sound formats. It uses AVC and MPEG-4 for video. The machine's UMD media can hold up to 2 hours of DVD quality video for hours of standard quality or whatever. That's just a comment there. So basically, it uses it is CD-based. It's actually like a little DVD. It looks like a mini disc recorder. Type CD, but it's actually a DVD, so it holds more data. So very interesting. The other thing I was talking about is I read something about because we have these, usually if we can try to integrate things, usually it's faster. So if you have the processor integrated along with a graphics processor together on the same die in the same object, the same thing.
Well, yeah, it has to travel less distances to do the same amount of work.
And higher bandwidth. So, of course, that would be problematic for people that want to, upgrade.
Yeah.
But,
that whole thing is if it breaks or whatnot, the whole thing's toast.
Yeah, so.
But while you do have it and it is working, it works better.
Yeah. Speaking of new technology, and we've talked about some great things lately about light-based processors and all sorts of stuff. Now, we talked about this story in the past. Basically, there was a group... in Illinois that broke the record for the fastest transistor. When they broke it that we read it previously, their transistor operated at 57 gigahertz, I think. No. It actually... Oh, this one operate. The new one operates 57 gigahertz faster than the old one. So the old one was in the range of like 448 or something like that. About 448 gigahertz. Well, their new transistor operates at 509 gigahertz.
Wow, that's a significant increase.
Yeah. That is 509 billion hertz, I think that is. That be billion? I think it's billion. It's mad. But it's still gigahertz. It's gigahertz operations per second, which it was not operations, but switching per second, which is extremely fast. So they don't have any hardware to match it with to where the entire system can operate at that speed, at least not yet. But they were able to develop a transistor that could do that fast.
But it doesn't. It's so to seem that it will. That it's just, you know, time will tell that we'll. That other stuff will come about.
Yeah, to plug these components in.
Yeah. That'll be amazing.
Yeah. And, jumping right along here. Let me ask you something, VR.
All right.
What do you think? Do you think having, web surfing available at work is a good idea? Now, letting the employees know you don't want them to waste time, some people like to limit what sites the employees can go to. What do you think? Do you think it's a...
I think everybody should be able to surf the web whenever they want, however they go, wherever they would like.
Well, not go out. You don't want them, like, surfing porn at work, do you? I mean...
Well, it depends.
Well, it depends on the job, I guess.
Exactly, because it actually could increase their productivity. Because they get this little release or whatnot. Or, you know, they take a power nap.
Wow.
Whatever.
well, there was this company that actually did a research into that. And it says that while web surfing on a job, it can lead to better time management, stress reduction, improvement of skill sets, and helping to achieve a balance between work and personal life.
Right on.
Yeah, it's not bad. I noticed some people would do that on their lunch break. They would, surf the web, pay their bills. I don't think I'd want to pay my bills over someone else's network, but pay their bills. Went on their Hotmail, sent emails. That's another thing I wouldn't want to do on another person's network. But it's not too bad.
But I can also see a lot of other benefits for it, that you're exposed to new information, that your brain kind of gets some mind candy going, and so you come back to work a little fresher.
Yeah.
You're not dealing with the same drudgery as you've been dealing with for the last 4 hours or whatnot.
Yeah. Well, for me, you know, I like it to read the news. I constantly would read the news. And I like talk radio, so I listen to talk radio on the radio. You know, it's kind of like surfing the internet if you get that news from the internet. And it's relaxing, you know, while I'm doing my work during the day. Plus, you know, here's another thing, planning. Or I said time management. You know, what if you got to go to a store and you look up some stuff you know, get a phone number or something like that. So there's some benefits.
Yeah, you can be much more efficient.
Yeah. Of course, you want to limit some content that, you know, try to, like, limit things that get sites or pop-up ads and trying to infect you with viruses and stuff like that. But it, generally, if you have good...
That just creates more work for the sysop. It's good.
Yeah. But generally, you know, it's if you got a good set of employees, should be a problem. All right. Well, we are moving over towards a little bit of Linux information. This is something very interesting. The mock and Darwin binary compatibility for NetBSD, PowerPC, and NetBSD i386 is here. Now, what that means... Let me read it here. Let me give you a few terms. Windows Server, okay? This is Microsoft. Windows Server is able to talk with the mock init to register itself. It then runs for a long period of time, opens the HID system, and frame buffer gives through the IO kit. It crashes after spawning a new thread. Next step is to debug the crash. Okay, so that... Actually, I thought that was going to describe it. It's actually talking about the status of this project, but... There's a component called Windows Server, and then there's another one called xDarwin, which is the X Windows Server for Mac OS X. And it says, let's see, it's fully functional. Display mouse and keyboard operations work through our IO kit emulation. Running X-Darwin has no interest in itself, but it ensures that our I.O. kit drivers emulations are good enough to be used with Windows Server. Let's see. Okay, let me read this. Once you have fully functional. Okay, basically, they're getting Darwin to run on top of NetBSD. And it's an interesting port to try to get it to come over. And, you know, Darwin is basically the kernel for Mac OS X. X-Darwin, and I think, what is it, Aqua? It's Aqua is the Windows manager. But X-Darwin is actually the Windows server, and then Aqua is like kind of like your GNOME or KDE. It's basically your desktop and is all of its features. So they're getting that to actually run on a NetBSD system for PowerPC and i386. So if we can bring that kind of compatibility over to Linux, that'd be a great thing. Let's see.
But yeah, then you have a huge amount of compatibility.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that can happen. Let's see. It says, once we have a fully functional Darwin binary compatibility on NetBSD PowerPC, we will just have to grab Mac OS X libraries to run any Mac OS X program, just like NetBSD is now able to run binaries from Linux, FreeBSD, Solaris, and many other OSs. So it's just merging the compatibility of Mac OS in to NetBSD at this point.
Yeah, then it's starting to sound like it's, yeah, everything can work, or, you know, and then you can also have your Windows stuff.
Yeah. So, choice.
It's all good.
Let's see. The Linux 2.6 kernel is getting closer to becoming out of the, you know, beta stages or... you know, it says revision 9, I think, is where it's at now. I think revision 10 is supposedly going to be the last one. Maybe it's on revision 10 now. I haven't really followed it that closely. But I was just reading an article here about some of the responses and things that Linus has talked about with the state of where, you know, Linux is going. Let's see. I'm just going to read this one off the cuff. One of the questions was, I want you to say something about Linux on the desktop and where it's going. We're going to talk about that with some of the responses that statements that Red Hat said. Linus says, I've always thought that Linux on the desktop is where it is, right? With a question. That's the only part I care about. Servers are kind of ... They're easy. They only do one thing. The one thing may be on the end things, but at some time it's very tunable and very straightforward. People have been doing it for a long time. Server people usually do stuff that they've done for 10, 15 years. So I don't think servers are very interesting from a technical standpoint. It's all been done before. Desktop is what I use, and a desktop is technically more challenging anyway. Clearly, most people who use Linux on a desktop tend to be pretty technical right now. The nice thing is that it is changing. It's changing mainly inside companies that just decided, hey, our secretaries are actually better off using Linux because we don't want them playing solitaire. And there's some laughter. That's how DOS came to be, right? Linux has Solitaire too, but you can control better how to install it, right? People who bought PCs for home initially did so because they used them at work. That's the way things get done, and it does seem to be happening. And let's see if I can find some good questions here.
Yeah, so it seems that if you can get into the market share, into the business realm...
You're there. Word's ready.
Then it'll just trickle on down to the home arena.
Yeah.
Which, that makes the most sense.
See, the question is, you'd be surprised how clueless people are. This is a question of the meaning of open source. You'd be surprised how clueless people are. I get called all the time. I think I'd like to do this project and do it open source. What does that mean? They have no idea. Linus says, some people have had a hard time getting used to it. Many managers do tend to find it hard to let go of managing, and they don't take patches in from the outside, for example. They may be open source in the sense that they release the code and releases all the changes they make, but actually don't talk to anybody outside, so they're not communicating what's going on.
So they're still one way, they're still vector.
Yeah. Can you give an example of a company, they said? And Linus said, Intel's a good example because they used to be so closed. They had rules saying when you join the company, everything you write is ours as far as laws allow, and you can never ever use the company's email addresses publicly for anything, because that would imply that Intel endorses ... you know, whatever they were talking about. Or something like this. They used to be true five years ago, and had a lot of people who worked at companies like that for a long time, and then they needed to really change how they think, and they go through the courses, but these courses are not geared towards people who know what open source is, very introductory. Actually, there's a lot of stuff that was said, but basically, it's becoming more of a conscious knowledge that you know, Linux is going on many fronts and moving along. So you know, even with all the talk of SCO and stuff like that, so it's interesting to watch it. And obviously, there are people that are, I don't know, might not be a part of the community and break off, maybe, which I got a story about that. And hopefully, the true light and the true reason of Linux and the true philosophy of it, is a better way to put it, enables to continue on in to other operating systems and softwares, platforms, and so on, because it's really brought about a choice. It's really there for the consumers. That's really what it's all about. And
for the grace, from the grace of open source, there I go.
Yeah. So, my mind is actually really deep in thought this evening. So, if I'm sound a little spacey, it's because I am. Okay. All right. Well, this is something that happened recently, and I'm sure a lot of people that, you know, follow the news just a little bit has heard something about this. It says Red Hat. Red Hat basically says stick with Windows at home because they're going to be moving to their Enterprise Edition. Red Hat's chief executive has said that Linux needs to mature further before home users will get a positive experience from the operating system, saying they should choose Windows instead. Linux is seen by Microsoft as its most dangerous competitor for desktop operating systems, and after a number of high-profile cases where government departments have switched from Windows to Linux-based systems, OSs have been making some progress. However, Red Hat said that the hype around the desktop Linux is still mostly unfounded at the moment. Matthew Sudlick, chief executive of Linux vendor Red Hat, said on Monday, which is early this November, that although Linux is capable of exceeding expectations for corporate users, home users should stick with Windows. I would say that from the consumer marketplace, Windows probably continues to be the right product line, he said. I would argue that from a driver device standpoint and perhaps some of the other traditional functionality for the consumer, classic consumer purchaser, is my view that Linux technology needs to mature a little bit more. So look, as an example of his 90-year-old father going to a local retailer in order to purchase a computer with Linux. We know painfully well what happens when he will try to get it installed and either doesn't have a positive experience or puts a lot of pressure on your support systems, he said. However, Sudlick expects Linux to be ready in a couple of years, as it's had time to mature. In the meantime, he is adamant that the corporate users will be surprised at how much the operating system has to offer. Consumers want USB devices, drivers, and digital camera support, but for the enterprise desktop, it's a little bit different. So basically, it's for all the people that want to plug in all the goodies, and, you know, it doesn't have some of those things available. But you know what?
Wow, just that little press release. That is, I am just overwhelmed and in awe and respect of them going, you know what? Yeah, stick with Windows at home, because we're not mature enough. What other company would do that sort of thing?
Well, actually, no, I didn't think of it that way. And that is a positive. That is a good thing to think about. I did think of it as
like I want to go out and buy one just to support them now.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking at first. I was like, that is a pretty cocky thing to say, because here's what I'm saying. Here's what I'm thinking about. I think that Linux is ready for you to use a desktop in a different way. Now, it may not have some of the applications that you use, but Linux does provide a lot of things, and it actually provides it, and, you know, it's right, not from a typical consumer standpoint, but I think for someone, if they graduated from just being your typical consumer to your typical philosopher, your typical, you know, person that's, well, it wouldn't be non-typical, but, you know, it's a system that allows you to get as much out of it as you could possibly get out of it. So it's a different shift in thinking, you know, and there are digital cameras that plug into it and stuff like that. You know, you just got to make sure that you find the right one. But it's, I think it's ready for the desktop, but it's just a different mind frame. And I kind of think that his comments actually might have been a little abusive in the way he said them, just because it might give people the wrong idea.
Yeah,
because
it can be interpreted as, you're not ready for Red Hat yet.
Yeah, or you know, Linux is too stupid, and we need to be better like you for your digital cameras and all your crap you want to plug in. You know, so that's you know, that's kind of underdogging Linux. I mean, you could take it that way. Do you enjoy the fact, let's put it this way, do you enjoy the fact that you can plug in your digital camera, but your computer is infected with a virus and your information is stolen? Or you can't trust your computer or any of your data on it because of all the problems that are go along with it. Or
yeah, but
can you plug in those devices, but are you happy paying all those, you know, the higher price tag, the, you know, all the negative things that come involved? Are you happy, you know, when your system crashes and you got to rebuild it again because it sucks, you know? Is it not saying
it
every...
Because it just corrupts on its own. It's got like a little internal timer that goes
yeah.
off.
Yeah, so new versions out, break down.
Yeah.
So you can buy the new one. No, you know, I try not to do any uncalled bashing, obviously. I can build, and honestly, I can build a nice, you know, Windows box and keep it running, but, you know, I guess you could actually say consumers, it's kind of hard to screw up a Linux box unless you like just start randomly deleting files. But I don't know. I wasn't really happy with it because it could be interpreted in a lot of ways. And plus with the whole, I guess you could say, you know.
But like, I respected it for just the whole, like, him trying to be as honest or as truthful as he possibly can. He's like, you know, we want to have you have the best experience you possibly can with our product when we think you're ready for us.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of nifty.
Yeah. And, then, you know, yeah, they're actually taking, Red Hat's moving towards the Enterprise, which I think their Enterprise edition costs like $100. They're no longer offering like the free download or anything. What they do offer is Fedora, which I actually read a review of Fedora, and it wasn't very exciting. Because it's going to be like the little test bed for any new Red Hat stuff that they're going to make for the corporate edition. But, you know.
Wasn't that just witty calling it Fedora?
Yeah, Fedora. So, that is that on that.
Yeah, I'm done.
I did get a lot of information, and it wasn't talked about too much. There was a few BugTrack emails sent back and forth, but somebody seemed to try to put a backdoor in the Linux kernel. So somebody has modified the CVS tree in kernel.bkbits.net directly. And this is an email message, actually. Dave looked at the machine, and it looked like someone may have been trying to break in and do it. And we fixed the file in question. The conversion is done back here at a bit mover, and after we transfer the files, we check them and made sure they're okay. And this file got flagged. The CVS tree is fine. You might want to remove the updated exit.c to make sure that you have the current version in your tree, however. Basically, it's just an email describing the fact that someone did try to get in and modify some source code to the Linux kernel.
Well, see, there, that illustrates a really interesting. I kind of might foresee a problem is somebody can actually put, like, a backdoor in something, put it out there for the community to use, and it goes undetected, and then they have kind of free range with all the people who downloaded that program.
Yeah. You know, and you can do that to anything, but I guess you could say the benefit of open source, and not everyone's going to be looking at every piece of code all the time. Well, one of the benefits is that it's available, and you can look at it, and you can change it, too, if you'd like.
Yeah, so there's an opportunity, you know, there's some, you know, it's a tool that can go both ways.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, Linux is going to have more holes over time because it's going to be building more functionality. And, you know, there's also a lot of things that, you know, Microsoft is going to learn from Linux's model, and they're going to incorporate that. And they're going to try to take the best of Linux and take the best of Microsoft and say, well, just come over here. You know, we've got everything going on. And, you know, I don't believe Microsoft is going anywhere. But at least you have...
Unless they get into the alternative fuels industry. That'd be kind of... I would be rather disappointed by that.
What do you mean?
Actually could have the capital to pull off a whole, you know, infrastructure change, your conversion from, you know, fossil fuels into alternative.
Well, I believe that they...
But they would have to sell off everything, shut down. And that could be why I thought about that.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, it's, look, folks, it's here to stay. And Linux and this kind of idea is going to be one of your major choices, too, in the future. So that's a good thing. And actually, these conversations about, you know, all those conversations about Netscape versus Internet Explorer, they no longer happen. Why? Because Netscape tanked. Or even if they didn't tank and they're both around, doesn't matter. You know, it'll get to the point where we won't even be talking about the difference between Linux and Microsoft.
It'll just be, that's what it is.
That's just what it is. And there'll be a point where we don't even talk about computer hardware, because you'll just have a dummy terminal, nice, you know, monitor fibered up to some, you know, neighborhood box.
Oh, yeah. That'd be beautiful. We all have, like, all our walls are actually flat screen, or liquid crystal displays, and we can be completely immersed in whatever kind of surroundings we so choose at the time.
Yeah. And, you know, the... after that, I think it might be everyone's going to start focusing on social issues. Because the internet, everything...
Because then we'll start getting stuff plugged into our brain.
Well, that's going to be bad, but yeah, that's going to happen.
And they get different kinds of, like, eyes and have genetic, you know...
Hey, for you non-believers, call us weird, but, you know, I'll have a beer waiting for you when when you want to sit down and talk about it, because it'll happen.
Oh, yeah. When you can start, like, changing what kind of spectrum spectrums you see, and what can you feel. Oh, and then screw societal issues. You're just going to sit home and plug genes into your genome and see what kind of things you can find out about yourself in the universe.
And then it's going to be the battle between the man and the machine.
Oh, yeah. But you know, was it...
That would be insane if we actually created a city called Zion when that happened,
yeah,
based on the movie.
That would be pretty... But you know what? That would be the most fitting name for it.
Yeah.
And if it actually did come about, I really foresee about a 90% chance that that would actually be its name.
Yeah.
And it'd probably be in, like, Southern Utah.
Southern Utah. But, yeah. Yeah, that's, it's moving. It's got to stay, slow moves, you know? Staying up to date with what's going on. It's going to allow you to make the best decision for yourself. All right. Well, this is something new, and I kind of like it. It makes sense in some degrees. Microsoft will announce on Wednesday, which this is back in early November, that will offer two $250,000 bounties for information that leads to the arrest of the people who released the MS Blaster Worm and the So Big virus. This is the first time in history that somebody has come up with, has offered money for information about the identity of a cyber criminal.
Really?
And so they're going to continue to do that. There's actually a whole, I forget the link, but there's something on Microsoft's site where you can go and check out what they're willing to pay for certain viruses, or if they're going to pay, for people that are going to release malicious viruses for Windows.
You know, which that actually brings about a whole new little industry of, like, you know, cyber bounty hunters. And
have you seen Cowboy Bebop?
A little bit.
On Cowboy Bebop, they're bounty hunter. You know, they're like bounty hunters.
Yeah.
And they have that, usually on most of the shows, the episodes or whatever, they'll have that little show that comes up where it's this girl guy and they're cowboys, or they usually dress up in, like, different outfits. But they're like talking about the newest bounty hunter.
Uh-huh.
Like, go ahead and go round him up and get this new bounty hunter. He's worth, 5,000 creds or whatever the currency was. And so people would go out and try to find this guy and pull him in and...
Yeah, get him.
And, yeah. I mean, that's what, in that period of time, they're in space. So obviously you got to get bounty hunters to go do that.
Yeah.
Because you can't have cops everywhere in the galaxy. But people sure like money, so...
Yeah, it's a whole lot cheaper and probably much more effective.
Yeah, because you know what, with these viruses and these exploits and the damage that they cause to corporations actually causes a lot of money to be lost, downtime and such like that.
Well, and most aren't even reported.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to have the perceived insecurity and people lose their trust in the in their infrastructure and their services.
Yeah. And since that happens...
So, like, you know, for $250,000, I might sit home and, like, try to track people.
Yeah.
Try to find out who they were.
Well, the cost of the bounty is actually a lot cheaper than the cost of the problem.
That's right. So if they start doing this more proactively, which it sounds like they're doing, that is probably going to be the most effective thing, except in the case where, you know, if they bring in the Patriot Act, and then it becomes this kind of preemptive thing if you were thinking about maybe doing a malicious thing and now you're up for treason and the death penalty for even contemplating or speaking about an exploit of, you know, a software product.
Well, you know what?
And that's pretty scary.
Well, you know, what really separates us from getting to that is having the ability of controlling and tracking and monitoring that. And that's what we're getting close to being able to do more and more all the time. Controlling and tracking and monitoring. And it's those types of things because, you know, you couldn't have, maybe 100 years ago, have the types of things that they had nowadays for tracking and monitoring in these systems that people were tied up in. There was no credit card. There was no phones. There was no internet. There was no driver's licenses. There was no social security numbers. There was none of that. So, you know, how were these humans tracked and monitored and stuff like that? There wasn't. They just did a good old lynching. And they'd hang you in front of everybody else and said, if you piss us off, we might stick you up there in the rope and hang you. You know, and that was it. So it was the gun, you know, it was the weapon, it was the hangings, it was...
But there was a whole lot less anonymity. Like, your name, you know, was all you had. And so if you went somewhere else, you probably could change your name, but there are so few people, you know, there are much fewer people, that you would run into somebody eventually who would know you by your old name. And now, if those two paths crossed, your whole life just went down the drain, and now everybody who's you've done anything with now doesn't trust you and can't trust you.
Yeah.
And so you're pretty much done. That's worse than a life. That's worse than death, is it's almost a living death.
Yeah. But where I was really going with this is that we're integrating human everything into systems, and it's going to lead to a revolution, I believe.
Yeah. Except if we let it get to the whole thought police thing, and then it might be able to squash any kind of revolutionary ideas.
Yeah. I mean, and there are people out there in power that don't want things like that. I mean, we always talk from a standpoint, it's us and them. Us and them. Them and us. But, I mean, there are people in those positions to make decisions that affect people's lives that have good thoughts, you know?
Yeah.
So, there's not the all lost hope, but... Believe me, you know, humanity likes to figure out how far it can push the boundaries. And I don't put it past them to touch some of these boundaries. Well, we talked about Microsoft and the fact that they really would like to buy Google. And it seems like Google said, nope, we're going to be doing our own thing. We don't really need you. And this is just a little bit more information about... Microsoft trying to get further along in the in the search engine wars. Microsoft has hired Paul Ryan, a former CTO of pay-per-click service firm Overture Services, to lead its push into search technology. The move comes from several days after the software giant announced its plans to divide its MSN division into two units, one to focus on informational products, including its portal and forthcoming search tools, and the other to focus on communication, including its Hotmail and Messenger services. Microsoft has made it clear that it aims to become a major player in the search sector and has been investing heavily in developing its own search technology over the past year. Reports suggest that Microsoft is approaching Google with a takeover offer. Oh, this is old news. Yeah, they really want to get into it. And I think they want to be able to put their hands in any large technological area. And search engines is one that people are going to go to, and there isn't that many out there.
Yeah.
I mean, many, you know, talking 20, you know, something like that. And if that, people search maybe 5 of those or less. All right, we're going to end up in our SCO section here. I don't have a meme to flush the toilet, but, well, if you were heard the last show, that was actually our opening to the SCO section. So, picture...
Yeah, that was brilliant.
Picture a flushing toilet in the background of your mind now. Okay. Well, now, SCO, it's getting into the point where people need to reveal what they got. They need to start showing the evidence. Show the proof.
Put up or shut up.
Put up or shut up. And basically, SCO is saying IBM needs to give us more documents and we need to give them less. One of the things they said here, it says SCO has provided 1 million pages of documents to IBM, and the IBM has returned, in return has only provided 100,000 pages to SCO. Says the foot is dragging on the part of IBM, he says. This is Sontag, which is a person of the court case. But, I don't know. Who knows?
Well, it sounds like if this was a poker game, that SCO would have like 50 cards and IBM would have like 3.
What do you mean?
Or 5. You know, because SCO is wanting to be dealt a lot more information that they want to have it in their hand. And everybody else has so little, so... Of course they can go, oh, yeah, you got 3 aces? Well, guess what? I got 5.
Well, see, you know, it's hard to really tell what's going on because these stories don't really tell you the intricacies of what's going on. I mean, obviously the lawyer of that case can, you know, is really going to be able to, or the lawyers of that case are really going to be able to the ones to describe what's really happening. SCO provided 1 million pages of documents, you know. You got to really ask yourself, is the information worthy? Is it interesting? Is it of anything really a bearing on the case? So they've gotten so worried about getting information. I think IBM is actually the one we're talking about that's been so worried about getting information. They are now turning to third parties for information. So they're actually going out and subpoenaing them and discovery process for their case. And, you know, I think when SCO, because they're what they've brought to the table so far as their argument goes, is really flawed in many points and outrageous in some others, that obviously the Cole court case is going to be a twisted abusal of the law and backed by Microsoft and other interested companies and all that stuff. Let's see. What's on the reply to the to that? Oh, yeah, SCO is actually doing migration incentives. Basically, move away from Linux, please, or we're going to have to charge you these things. Yeah. Organizations running Linux unwilling to pay SCO's Group Inc. IP license could find themselves running Unix or Windows under a planned exit clause from the company. SCO Group has revealed its plans migration options extending the intellectual property program launched earlier this year. We're offering a migration path to other operating systems that have a stronger IP basis than Linux, IP being intellectual property. Incentives will be offered in the coming months. SCO claimed that the migration program was conceived following feedback from some of its users and decided if Linux is no longer free that they would move back to Unix. The company claims, though, it will do little to silence conspiracy theorists who believe SCO is working for Microsoft Corp, blessing the undermined Linux. Many corporations are banning Unix for Linux because of the cost, and it's debatable whether SCO's Unix for a runtime license would outstrip the cost of running a Unix server. Microsoft, meanwhile, emerged as one of the first ISVs to take out a SCO license.
Hmm.
I don't know. You know, their license I don't know what the price is now, but it was $700. It's a whole operating system. You know, their code is minuscule if it's in there.
Yeah.
And they want $700? You can buy Microsoft Windows for three. You know, it's
That's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, there were a company.
They're just wanting to like squash them, put them out.
Yeah, there were a company ready to disappear. You know, until they came up with this charade or third party. You know, tap their shoulder and who knows? You know, whatever we could be as us conspiracy theorists over here. Call us logical theorists, and what they're doing is totally illogical.
Because there's one of the main reasons why we do anything is for power. That's it.
Yeah, you know, they wouldn't do it because they're so worried. It's because they were going nowhere. And
They're not doing this because it's right. It's to gain more power before they, you know, go away or whatnot, or try not to go away. So they're just scrambling for power.
Yeah. Well, one of the big places that SCO was attacking, too, is Hollywood. Hollywood has basically used a lot of Linux machines. Basically, I think around 300,000. Let's see. There was a large number of Linux machines that helped produce graphics and special effects for the movie industry. And basically, SCO is attacking them as well. And I think some of them are rejecting SCO. Some of them are paying. And they're definitely not migrating because they've seen the benefits. So that's another interesting bit of information from our SCO section as it plays out to its end. Well, that is all I have for news. So now it is time for our review or our thoughts of Matrix Revolutions. So if you haven't seen the movie, tune out now. And if you have and you like some more info, or just want to hear the general discussion, stay on board. Woo woo. Yeah. So okay, well, I saw it and
on the In the Now train.
Yes, on the In the Now train, chugging along. You know, I saw the movie and I've heard a lot of people's reactions. I think for most people that are intellectual that I've spoken to, I don't know. It's kind of mixed. I don't know why. But I thought it was a great movie. I thought that it really played out well. I thought that it showed a lot of things. And we're going to discuss some of the points. And it's good because I think VR disagrees with me a little bit on it, and that's going to help us divulge some information.
Well, I was kind of disappointed because of how I thought that they were kind of setting it up from the second one to the third one. Of how, because as like the governor or whatever was, or one of the council people was talking about how that living in Zion, that they're still dependent on the machines in order to live. That it's still kind of like being hooked up to the Matrix. And I thought that was kind of a precursor of this whole thing of that when Neo actually was able to destroy the squids in one of the tunnels without being hooked up to the Matrix or without a weapon, it was just his own mind that he realized he self-awakened into the next level, which was the whole, you know, war between Zion and the machines was just another level of the Matrix.
And he became the one within the human world, though.
Right. So it became actualized in a weird way. So that's why I was kind of disappointed that I wanted that excitement, but it didn't happen, and that's about the only thing I'm really disappointed about.
Well, here's my excitement. Okay, here's my favorites in order is 3, 1, and 2. Now, the reason I put the first movie after the third movie is because the third movie takes all that excitement from the first movie and caps it, there's no capping. I mean, it still can go.
It's a culmination of all of them.
Yeah. Now, the second movie is you're understanding more of the computer world, you're understanding more of Neo's relationship with Trinity, you're understanding, you know, Morpheus and his, you know, seeing that it wasn't a planned prophecy. But, you know, I could really go on forever to describe all these things. People didn't understand, you know, and I think I'm right in what I say. People don't understand what the fighting it really is. The fighting is hacking. The fighting is, they're both programs when they're in the Matrix. And actually, of course, when you're out, we could call ourselves programs too. But we're highly evolved. And, you know, our stimuli and our, you know, we have a lot of randomness in our system and stuff like that. But the fighting is actually hacking. I mean, they're trying to destroy the other entity via whatever means. And the way they see things, it's not the way you see things on the movie screen. It's in this deep, you know, quantum, you could say, level. Many dimensions and things like that. You know, the ending, some people didn't understand. Basically the movie is that, you know, Zion was not destroyed. A portion, because they had, basically they were blocking the tunnels with the their craft, and they're ready to do EMP at the right moment when they came to kill a lot of the, you know, they call them squiddies, before they actually entered the main area of Zion. And then they were ready that once they took a good, because they take a, you know, a large amount out, it's another defensive, it's a level of defense, they would take that them out, and then they would, the squiddies would, whatever was left, would come down into Zion, and then they would yet again use their means of attack down there. And then what happened after, you know, all those things were going on is that, you know, Neo had a talk with the Oracle and basically found out, going along the lines of what he already knew, he just then realized he was on his own. The Oracle could not provide, you know...
Because she could only see as far as he could because of all the intersections of thought and of choice that he didn't understand a decision that he had to make, and she didn't understand a decision that she had to make, and they were pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
It was about how they were going to, you know, to get what they inevitably wanted.
Yeah. Now, as I do this review, I know I'm going to, as soon as I turn off the microphone, I know I'm gonna miss 1,000 points I've already discussed with people.
Oh, yeah, because the intricacies of it. Just amazing, the whole movie.
Yeah.
The series.
It takes a discussion to actually pull them out. You can't just lay it out in order.
No, because they go back and forth, and you see insights from, like, the third one that were, you know, like, I want to watch all three, like, back to back.
Yeah.
And just have this just mind blow session.
So, you know, Neo and Trinity actually get separated from the rest of the group. Did you find out Neo's still alive? He gets separated from the rest of the group. Of course, Neo fights Agent Smith, who actually appears, and I forget his name, but he's one of the other ship crew. So he's a human. Neo...
Yeah, which that's a whole interesting little thing that actually a program, you know, took over a, you know, a human form.
Yeah.
That was really neat.
Yeah.
Of being able to cross over.
And why not? Because they were so intertwined in each other's worlds... seem like there's no reason to why not to jump back. It just wasn't...
Well, yeah, it was just that the human mind was kind of where it was going, or where, you know, where most of the integration was taking place.
Yeah. So, you know, he had realized what had happened there, so they're finding, like, these new found powers of Agent Smith, and Neo obviously is rapidly advancing in his own understanding of what his purpose and power is. And then, of course, we have the Battle of Zion, and that was absolutely amazing. The way it was planned out, and obviously the movie tackling so many different ideas at one point in time, and showing you in a sequence, and you know, explaining how things happened, you get to see some pretty interesting things about even just in the battle. You got to see, you know, the will of the humans to go on. But another thing that was very interesting...
Yeah, especially in, like, the fight with, you know, Neo and Smith, is Smith was asking him, why do you keep getting up? And he was like, I choose to. It was just the sheer choice of... that's what he was going to do.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't any alternative that he could. Well, yeah, he could.
Other than
to
fail, but why?
Yeah, he didn't have to. Because he could succeed.
We'll get to that, because there's a lot of things going on there. But the one thing that I really really was paying attention to, one of them, one of the many things, was when you saw that machine that was drilling through Zion, drilling down to Zion, and then it was trying to drill deeper into Zion. It had these legs that would hold the drill up so it could continue drilling. And what the people in Zion were trying to do was to destroy those legs. And you could see how all the squiddies were around to try to protect the legs. And they got to a point where, they destroyed its support enough to where it couldn't walk. And it was continually trying to get up. And you could see, for the first time, the machines were weak. You know?
Yeah.
They were weakened. And the whole thing was coming into balance in your brain, like, for me, watching it. Seeing that we still made a difference despite this army, and also seeing
this almost unlimited army that's kind of just keeps coming and coming and coming.
Yeah, and also, I mean, there's so many things going on. It's our fight with the machine. Strategically, but then also internally, mentally, the fight with. What was going on inside the Matrix, and along with Neo and Agent Smith, you were seeing that humans were just as powerful as these so-called more powerful machines. But they were also very similar in a lot of ways, too. That's a lot of things that the second movie and the third movie were showing you. They were both flawed. Human beings were flawed, and so were machines.
And that was neat about the third, is that it brought a clear round back over to the human issue.
Totally the inverse. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Our flaw was the dependence on mechai or, other things doing functions for us. And then, the functions found out, the machines found out that their dependence on, or that there was no true way that they could find to control and balance themselves, because they found a weakness, which is where Agent Smith had crossed with Neo to where he was more of a humanized machine, except he was still drawn by his purpose, which, Neo originally took away his purpose, but after that he saw all-encompassing power. And in the movie he actually takes over, because he can multiply himself, he actually takes over the Oracle.
Well, that we have a purpose just the same as, like, Smith does. Or Smith found that he still had purpose, and we all have purpose, and that's why we get up in the morning and do what we do.
I think that he was so...
But we call it meaning.
Yeah. I think that he was so enthused, so enraged in his functionality is growing beyond itself, that he never asked himself the question, does it ever end?
Yeah.
And I think that's what he finally realized, and that's why he became weak, because then it was the equation to undo all equations for himself. He said, from what the Oracle had told him, that all things come to an end, he did not ever process that in his thinking. I don't believe. This is my, my philosophical... A philosophical understanding of it is that once he realized that, there's a few fronts. One was that the humans are always going to have...
Well, I think it was actually because how the Oracle said that Smith and Neo were, like, positive and negative. That when Neo allowed Smith to infect him, he used, Wu-Wei to yield and overcome, which then created Zero, which, just balanced everything out. And poof, he died at the same time, and, the Matrix, the Architect was able to, essentially reload the Matrix, and everything was happy-dandy.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I don't know if they reload the Matrix. I think it's sat there. Well, okay, here's the thing.
Well, that's why it's called Reloaded.
Well, that's this Revolutions.
Oh, whatever.
But
yeah, well, even I wanted to call it like Reloaded then, after the second one.
Oh, well, here, okay. So Agent Smith basically realized that he had a weakness, and that pretty much took him out. because he was so thriving on the power, and then once he realized the weakness, it was such a opposite effect. You know, it really, you know, ended up destroying himself, kind of a self-destruct type thing. But okay, here's the thing. Dimitri said, "How could they ever allow? Shouldn't they be able to have some control to where they can get rid of Agent Smith? You know, unplug or something like that." I tried to answer that. I tried to answer it because he could not fathom how maybe that they should be able to control and contain him. Well, here's my idea. There's a few things that happen here. One is, and this is a major one, that Agent Smith was able to do what no machine has done. You know, he was outside of the realm of their built-in boundaries.
Well, yeah, well, he even said in the that when it was his time to, like, be deleted, he chose not to. And that's what freed him from all the constraints of a program.
Yeah, so the thing is that he's part of the human problem that the architect couldn't quite fix. And that's why they had the Matrix and this whole... Well, that was to sustain the human mind, but it was also...
Because he chose free will.
Yeah, but there was also systematic, built-in systems for trying to keep the person that is too much of a free will and too much of a problematic for the, you know, Matrix to, you know, eventually get, phased into something else to where the Matrix can continue on. But the fact that he could do that, even if the machines could turn him off or stop him, they cannot possibly equate, because they don't understand why it happened in the first place.
Yeah, that's really what it was, because
they cannot equate.
Yeah,
how to stop it again?
It.
Yeah, so they knew that they had a fundamental flaw. Actually, it's not even a fundamental flaw. They actually just had a flaw that was so buried and entrenched deep within. You know, it could almost go to religious implications, and also that maybe they couldn't turn them off, and when Neo said, you know, the machine says, like, why would I need you, a human, or I forget exactly the quote, but he was like, okay, well, I must have miscalculated, you can kill me now. Well, that was because the machine had a bit of an ego to where they already, you know, built among themselves the idea of being, that humans were inferior. Well, that's why he first made the mistake of, like, doubting Neo. But then once Neo challenged his logic indirectly, he basically said, all right, well, we can't lose. We'll just kill you anyways, or you can go in and try to fix this problem, because guess what? We can't. And you seem to be the closest thing to do it. And also, another pivotal thing that's happening is that the machines, at this point, have now acknowledged that the strength of Neo, the human,
has value,
and it's not inferior to the human. So everyone has something to learn, and through that happening, and obviously Neo didn't die, you know, they didn't kill him, it didn't show his death or his living, but obviously he's still around.
Oh, he's dead.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. He's crucified. Actually, you know, like, that was his sacrifice, was that it was his ultimate existence, it was the meaning of his existence to...
What does mean he was... Well, you could be right, I don't know the answer, but he could also be used to take what his understanding is and be a mediator, a governor, a go-between between the humans and the machines.
Well, that would give him more power with the, like, machines, because he was able to do something that they couldn't do. So they wouldn't... It wouldn't be a very good negotiator. But to truly have a nemesis, do you believe, is just... my idea of a nemesis is the only way to defeat them is also your own defeat as well.
Well, I think from what my feeling was, from my opinion of what happened, is that they realized in a in a quick instant, the need for the humans and the machines together. Like, not to coexist, but the fact that we both have value here, and so we both have some problems that we need to figure out. We don't know. We got to do some thinking here. And I'm thinking that, you know, Neo obviously was a leader of that ideology that brought the humans to the next level and challenged the machine world. And of course, when they're talking to Oracle later, they're like, how long do you think it's going to last, the architect? Because he's a disbeliever. And you know, the Oracle says, as long as it can. And I think that means that the humans are going to have to be like, they're going to have to do a lot of, there's going to be a lot of talking going on. You know, obviously, they need the power, right? So they're still going to be kind of the Matrix. But maybe, and this is all total speculation, but maybe, maybe that they can find a way both together to get beyond the skies, which was was beautiful.
Yeah, that was a great thing when they breached the cloud, the pollution or whatever, and they were actually in the pristine blue sky.
For some reason, when I saw that blue sky, I felt like I was zapped out of the Matrix world and back to like where I was sitting at. You know what I mean? Like because before it was like a movie.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, I saw the sky. I'm like, oh, that's where I am. You know what I mean? Like, we have that sky. You know, so it was kind of weird. I had this weird weird feeling to where I'm always, every time I watch a movie, I'm thinking, like, this other area, this other world.
Yeah.
But then when I saw that sky, something that resembled the world that I see, then I was zapped back to my seat, and I was like, oh, yeah. So then it started affecting me when I watched them when they went back, because I was like, oh, because it brought it together for me for some reason. And, it's just amazing, and I think that it showed so many things when the computer was talking to Neo, and or the master control program, you could say, like from Tron, was talking to Neo, and he showed his ignorance to humanity. Neo called him on it. He responded like, "Okay, come help us out."
Yeah,
and those things were pretty powerful. You know, my problem is the viewers that see that movie and they're just like, you know, where's the action? Hey, oh, they're talking. You know, shut up, architect. But, you know, when they didn't understand. They thought it was all kung fu and special effects. You know?
Yeah, but there's so much more insight.
And it can go back to you could take all the different movies and merge them together and see all the different things that happen, and they all accented each other very well. Well, that's could probably go on forever, but that's my take. And of course, you can always go to the forums and post stuff, and we can try to talk about the Matrix there. You know, also I made a little button. If you go to the In and Out page, which is slipnet.org, and then go to In and Out, you can see a little In and Out button that we have. And if you like the show, feel free to advertise for it on your site. We don't do much advertising ourselves because, I don't know, I'm kind of weird when it comes to that. But, if you like it, I want you to advertise it.
But then it's also easier for you to get to the show because all you have to do is hit the button yourself.
Well, yeah, or make it your homepage. But my website's really simple, so there's nothing amazing there. All right. Well, I think that is going to wrap it up for our show this evening.
Sounds good.
Yeah. You know, the last show, it took me a few days to put it up. It's probably going to take me a little bit of time to put this one up. Very busy. Finals week. Crap like that going on. But it'll be up. And we're going to come at you with more and more and more. And
hitting us with, slapping us with orders of protection, then we might not keep throwing stuff at you.
Oh, man. I don't know why they'd do that to us.
Well, if we just keep coming at them and at them and at them, it's...
Oh, well, no, we're inadvertently. You just click on us. And
oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're safe.
Oh, okay, as long as you're not, like, trying to harass me.
We're good for the kids, too.
Good, good.
So...
That's true. We are, actually, kind of... Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I will see everyone in 2 weeks, and I'm signing out.
You know, later.
All right. We'll see you then.
We'll be right back.